the strangeness of that continent, of the fields of rice in the winds blooming golden and tidal like corn, of the crowds in their colours, and the tall narrow houses painted blue and yellow and red, and of the long surf rolling in at Madras. She said back then travellers were strangled in their sleep, and the Bengalis worshipped a goddess with a tongue of blood and a necklace of human skulls, and yet she herself had feared only the holy men wandering the cities with their roving eyes and tangled hair halfway down their shoulders, and the knuckled bones in their backs articulated and sharp. It was not a country, she said, but a world. Not a world, she said, but a passing through time. One grew old there. She said on her first afternoon on the river she had seen the body of an old woman in the mud bank being eaten by pariah dogs. Of course, death is only a gateway, she said. Our bodies hold us like locks. Like locks, murmured the lady. Locks, said William. She nodded. We cannot transcend without first breaking them open. Exactly, murmured the lady. William frowned. By transcend, you mean die. She shook her head. Nothing dies. It is only born into the next life. William studied her hard eyes and wondered what she had seen in this life that would lead her to such a pass. He did not yet know if she deceived or was herself deceived. She leaned closer. He could smell her skin. She wore no scent, no perfume. You think you do not believe, sir, she said, but nobody comes here who does not seek someone. You must not be frightened.
Frightened of what?
Of what happens this evening.
William smiled a cold smile.
And what is it you seek?
She did not take his meaning, or else chose to ignore it. She said calmly,
My mother, sir, but she has already found me.
William said nothing. He watched the soft man from the doorway come up behind her and nod in greeting, and without turning to acknowledge him, the medium said,
This is my brother, sir. Mr. Utterson. Mr. Pinkerton. Mr. Pinkerton is the guest of Mr. Fool this evening.
Utterson nodded. His eyelids were sleepy, but the eyes behind them were as hard as any William had seen, and stared out of the slack grey skin of his face with an unfriendly sharpness. The man leaned in close to his sister, and said in a surprisingly soft voice,
They are with thee, my dear.
William looked from one to the other.
Mr. Fool has not yet arrived, he said.
The medium smiled her strange smile. And just then the tall Sikh drew the beaded curtain aside, and Fool stepped into the parlour. His face, discoloured by a heavy bruise on one cheek, a scab of dried blood crossing the bridge of his nose. His forehead was knotted by worry, his silk hat unbrushed and dull. He looked drained and desperate and anxious. William's eyes met his, held. But already the medium was allowing her brother to take her elbow and lead her through the folding doors, and then the gas lights dimmed as if being choked slowly into darkness. He had witnessed too much suffering and horror as a young man at Antietam to think spiritualism's embrace of death anything but madness. The grave was the grave, the dead the dead. The worms fed and were fattened, had it not ever been so. Because he had been fast and strong for his size, he was named runner on a crew of eight for a parrot cannon that day, and he had begged his father to let him serve. Nights still came to him now when he would awaken in a panic. 20 years on, a man who occupied his time with violence and blood by choice, but for whom the nightmare of that morning still thundered in his skull and made him sick. It was September of 1862, his 17th year. The night before the battle, he had felt a roiling in his gut that the men of his battery called Death Belly. By common assent, it meant he would not walk away unscathed. That crew's last runner had been ripped in two at the waist by a splintering wheel as it fragmented off a cannon 10 yards away, and it had taken the pickers 3 days to bag the lad and haul his pieces by horse to the overfull graves. The gunner on William's crew was a boy of 20, and seemed impossibly old at that time, in that place. He showed William how to soak knots of rag in cold water, and stuffed them into his ears, and said the noise, when the firing began, would be a physical thing. He would feel it rustling the sleeves of his coat. He showed William how to mark out a line in the dirt and grass from the limber to the cannon, and explained that when the battle was underway, the smoke from the cannons would roll in great sheets over them, and he would see nothing but blur and fog and flares of light in the exploding chaos. All this proved true. They were positioned on high ground, and fixed their mark on the cornfield where the Texans would come rushing through, and when the battle was joined, the world dissolved into flame and smoke, and a shuddering earth that was nearly impossible for William to keep his balance upon. His task was to carry the 10-pound shells, one at a time, from the limber along the line to the gun crew, and he would stagger with the shell held low in both hands and his elbows locked, his eyes trained on the marks in the dirt, showing him the way. He could see only a murky fog, hear only the roaring. 30 minutes into the battle, a Confederate battery had fixed their position, and the hill burst around them and exploded into flame, whistling twists of iron scantling, spikes of wood, rock, dirt. There was a high whine, like a mosquito at his ear, and then William felt himself lift into the air and hang there for an impossible length of time, and then a gentle pain enfolded itself around him and massaged his knee between its thumbs, and then it started to crush him with a fury, and it tightened and tightened yet further. And when there was only the pain and the long darkness of what came next, he closed his eyes and descended. The air in the séance room was heavy with the scent of marigolds. William stood to one side of the folding doors and held his handkerchief to his mouth and breathed. He had heard stories of spirit cabinets, of floating objects, of ghostly figures manifesting in the corners of séance halls. Here afforded no such possibilities, cramped as it was. A bare round table without cloth of any kind filled the space, and the chairs surrounding were squeezed close, with their laddered backs scraping the walls. Thick purple drapes hung from iron rods at the ceiling, and a solitary lantern was burning on the table. Beside this, a small wooden box with its lid flipped back. Inside, a small brass bell. He waited for Fool and put out a hand, and Fool glanced up.
"I started to think you might not show," he said.
Fool smiled a tight smile.
"Mr. Pinkerton, you came."
William touched the skin under his own eye.
"How's your face?"
"Embarrassing."
They took their seats, as did all the others, and only the widower Gables stood with one hand resting heavily on two seat backs, as if uncertain which to take. The medium pressed her jeweled hands flat on the table and raised her head.
"We are only 9, Gabriel," she said.
Her brother glanced at the gathered sitters.
"Who's missing?"
She dipped her head and the gold hoops at her ears caught the light.
"Never mind it. I shall make the 10th.
"You cannot,"
she said. She gave him a quick, sharp look.
"You must be the guide."
His eyes took in the sitters one by one, and then William watched his slow eyelids lower, like the eyelids of a caiman, and he said,
"Tonight I shall be both. It will be fine."
He pulled the extra chair away from the table and took it through the doors, and returned after a moment and folded the doors shut behind him. They sat in silence as he took his seat, fastened the lid of the bell box shut, replaced it in the center of the table. He reached his left palm towards Mr. Gables, the ancient widower, shrunken and trembling, and took the man's fingers in his own.
"You must not, ladies and gentlemen, under any circumstances, break the circle. Do not let go of the hands of your neighbors. It would be most dangerous."
"Dangerous," William said with a quiet smile.
"Dangerous, sir, yes. We are bridging worlds in ways we do not entirely understand."
They all sat in the light of that dim lantern with the curtains close at their backs, and the bell set out before them, and their arms were stretched wide across the distances. William glanced at Fool, but the small man was studying the medium with a quiet seriousness and would not meet his eye. Something did not feel right. The medium had already closed her eyes and was breathing long, slow, steady breaths. Her brother said,
"I must ask you to concentrate now, all of you. I want you to focus your energy on the one you wish to contact this evening. Think of that person. Remember their smell, how they looked to you, the sound of their laugh. Many of you will have brought an atom that once belonged to them. You do not need to share it. Only think of it while we wait.
A minute passed. 2 minutes. He heard a soft murmuring from across the table and realized the medium was speaking to herself. It sounded like Latin. William watched Fool's eyes move between the medium and her brother. 10 minutes passed. 15. A quiet settled upon the narrow room. A warmth began to fill it. William could feel his eyes closing. He began to drift in an almost sleep. And then all at once the bell in its wooden box clattered harshly, and his eyes opened in alarm. His blood loud in his ears. Everyone sat unmoving, hands grasped in the faint light. The bell sat yet in its box in the center of the table.
There has been a contact, the brother said calmly. Have any sitters present felt anything?
No one spoke. The darkness of the drapery surrounding was absolute. It might have been folded from pitch. William breathed quiet, shallow breaths, listened to a creak in the ceiling overhead, the slow shirr of the drapery. He glanced at Fool's face, the thin gash of his mouth in the gloom. The smell of marigolds was overwhelming. For a long while the medium sat murmuring her prayer. Then the clapper in the box rang again, stark, violent, brash. William felt Fool startle beside him. The sound fell away.
There has been contact, the man repeated. Have any sitters present felt anything?
Now a lady's voice said,
I do. I feel something, yes.
It was the lady in the green shawl. Her eyelids were crushed shut. The man was studying her dispassionately.
What do you feel?
Hands. I can feel hands. On my neck.
She gave a brief shiver as she spoke, but did not open her eyes.
Do you feel anything else?
Oh, they're cold.
Rose,
the man said gently,
is there a message for this lady? Is there some word?
The medium sat with her face uplifted and her eyes closed, and the light cast a strange cage of interlaced shadows over her lips and cheekbones. Her mouth was parted slightly, and her tongue pressed against her lower teeth as if she might speak. A long silence followed, and then at last she spoke. Her voice was soft, hardly more than a breath.
The spirit says, you have come a long distance to be here,
she said.
The spirit says, you must travel a long distance back. There is a woman who brings a message from the shining world, a young woman with red hair. Her hands are white. She is reaching towards you.
William felt an uneasiness rising in him. The medium's brother inclined his head towards the lady with the green shawl.
Mrs. Caldwell, do you know this spirit?
She wet her lips.
My mother,
she said softly.
She died October last.
It is not your mother,
the medium murmured.
She is here also. It is not her. My aunt? I am hearing a name. It begins with an H. Hester? Does Hester mean anything to you? No,
she said.
The H is important. Can you think of anyone whose name begins with an H? My aunt, Hetty? It is not her. Anyone whose name has an H in it?
The lady was turning her face side to side in the weak light, and William watched the purple curtain behind her ripple and elongate and ripple.
Could it be Martha, my sister? We lived in Hull when we were girls.
The medium was silent, and then she gave a sigh as if some breath not her own were leaving her body, and she opened her eyes and said, smiling,
Martha says hello, Susan. Martha? Is it her? Truly? She asks what you would like to know. Oh, God. Oh, God!
There was a long silence then in that blackness, and William felt the dampness of Fool's hand in his own, the strength in the sinews there as he gripped and gripped. William's feet were flat on the floorboards, and he could feel a low drumming, as if someone was tapping their heels in a quick, fearful tap.
She says to tell you, Lizzie is happy,
the medium said.
Her suffering has ended. She says Lizzie's hair has grown back. Her eyes can see again. Oh, Lizzie,
the lady murmured.
Lizzie, Lizzie, my little bird.
And she started to cry, soundlessly, her sharp, narrow shoulders racked by it. Do not break the circle, the brother warned. Hold fast, hold fast. They were silent then a long time, and the medium began to murmur her prayer over and over. Perhaps 20 minutes passed, perhaps more. The lady in the green shawl had ceased crying and sat luminous and filled with grief like a vessel that had found its purpose, and William studied the lines in her face and thought of the grifters he had known capable of manipulating such suffering. When he glanced at Fool, he saw a man transfixed by longing and regret, and he wondered suddenly if Fool, too, found this crooked and dishonest. The bell in its wooden box rang again. There has been contact. Have any sitters present felt anything? No one spoke.
Rose, her brother said. Rose, is there a presence?
She rolled her head slowly forward as if following some scent with her eyes shut and her arms outstretched, and then she shook her head.
It is gone,
she said. 10 minutes passed. They waited again. The bell clacked loudly. There has been contact. Have any sitters present felt anything? Fool cleared his throat.
Mr. Fool, sir, did you feel something?
No, he said. I thought I did. It was nothing.
Nothing?
No. I have a presence,
the medium said abruptly.
A presence is coming through.
Whom does it seek?
Her brother asked. She sat very still as if listening at an open window to music playing somewhere. She said, hesitantly,
A man comes to us tonight. A man in pain.
What is his name?
William could feel Fool gripping his hand hard. She was silent.
Whom does the presence seek?
Her brother asked again.
The spirit says, Do not mourn. You are loved even still.
Yes.
The spirit would like to tell you that there is nothing to forgive. What was left unfinished on this side will be finished on the next. The spirit says, The war. I see the war and a betrayal.
Did he die in a war?
A name. Ignatius.
William felt the hairs on the back of his neck prickle.
Ignatius, the brother said. Is it the spirit of Ignatius who comes to us?
She grimaced, as if in pain. All at once she turned her sightless face, and something had shifted in her. And when she spoke now, her voice had roughened to the husk and gravel of a man's voice, a faint Virginian bend in the vowels.
What is this place?
It said.
Do not be frightened,
her brother murmured. His eyes looked carved from darkness.
You are between worlds. You are here with a message for this world. What would you have us hear?
You sound so far away. I lost so many things. I lost.
What would you have us hear?
It was silent.
How is it in that world?
The brother asked. It shook its head.
I was in a river, it said. A black river. Then I was on the shore.
How is it in that world?
It sat slumped with its sightless gaze fixed outward, and said nothing for a long moment, then murmured, as if by rote,
Other than the world as it was.
Yes, good. And what did you take with you to that shore?
My skull opened like a flower, it said. The night smelled of dust. Someone was crying. Oh, someone was crying.
And what did you take with you to that shore?
I took a darkness with me to that shore.
And
in the darkness, another darkness.
The man's eyes were fixed on his sister, and there were twin pricks of light deep in the sockets there, and William stared at them, feeling a kind of horror.
And were you young in this world?
I felt old. My legs wouldn't hold me.
You were. You were young, as are we all. And were you forgiven?
It had lowered its face, and with its arms outstretched, it looked to William like a figure crucified and sorrowing. At last it murmured,
"She is here, Edward."
Fool gave a low groan, his eyes staring.
"Who is with us now?" the brother pressed. "What is her name?"
"She is here,"
it said again, face lowered and lost to sight.
"She is at peace. She says, do you remember the flavored ices in Port Elizabeth long ago? She says it is that warm and peaceful here. She knows what is in your heart. She wants you to know she does not blame."
All at once William felt his right wrist twist, his grip give way. Fool was staggering upright, his chair falling away in a clatter, his face very white. And then the medium was staring with her eyes glassy and dazed, and her brother was shouting, and Fool had pushed past all of them, and the circle, whatever it was, whatever it had been, was broken. Later that night, he saw. He sat in his underclothes at his hotel window and, through the leaded glass, saw. Night, coalescing in the cobblestones below. A lamplighter in a cloak appeared like a messenger out of the shadows, and he watched the hooded figure lift a long hooked stick from one shoulder to reach the street lamp above. Everything felt so far away. The ordinary world in all its wonder and strangeness. He heard again the medium's dreadful voice as she spoke the name Ignatius. He thought of the balloonist, Ignatius Spar, whom he had fought with at Malvern Hill. Thought of the man's soft Virginian accent, the crackle in his voice. Spar had died in that battle.
"I see a war," the medium had murmured. "I see betrayal."
Down in the street, the lamplighter unhooked the wrought iron casing, the small pane of glass creaking open. Something inside William was clicking through its chambers, at the edge of violence, like a revolver seeking its bullet. The lamplighter turned a cog with the sharp point of his hook until a hiss of gas from the fishtail jet leaked out. It was not the war that killed that boy, Fool had told him in the tunnel.
"The man you want to talk to," Martin Reckitt had said, "is Adam Fool."
The figure swung down the staff, reached hand over hand for the end, adjusted the wick, hefted all of it smoothly back up to pass through the gas. The man, the boy, Adam Fool, Edward Shade. A bloom of flame, a spill of light across cobblestones.
"She is here, Edward," the spirit had said.
William crushed his eyes shut. Something stilled inside him. He was thinking of the seance, the clatter of the overturned chair, the alarmed shine in Fool's eye, and all at once he opened his eyes. His hands were shaking, for he knew who Adam Fool was. The Balloonist, 1862, Virginia. 32 years later, in the shadow of a new kind of war, William Pinkerton would sit across from a lady columnist from a New York daily and try to describe the horror that had been Malvern Hill. The great ocean-going turbines shuddering up through the floor, the sound of violins drifting past the portholes. This would be in the first-class viewing lounge of an Atlantic passenger liner, William smothering the palsy in his hands, returning from a police conference in Glasgow. Somewhere in the Europe behind them, aeroplanes were dropping bombs on boys cowering in trenches, and he could only shake his head helplessly at that, and frown. And in his frown was the bitter squint of a man who could no longer see, as he was accustomed to seeing. "It would mean so much to hear the truth of it, Mr. Pinkerton," she was saying, "especially now." He ran a weary claw over the blanket in his lap.
"The truth of Malvern Hill."
"Oh, yes, my readers would be so fascinated."
He peered out of the porthole at the passing grey of the ocean, of the sky. Somewhere out there, German warships slid like smoke over the waters.
"Your father was the head of the Union Army Secret Service at that time. Did you join him out of a sense of patriotic duty?
or was it because you'd heard he had fallen ill?
William crashed his eyes shut. He had been 16 then. He had been immortal.
Oh, don't look so abashed, she laughed. You were very young, Mr. Pinkerton. I understand he was sick with malaria at the time. You were still a boy, but you stayed by his side. You must have been awfully brave.
I didn't know what brave was, William said. If I'd had any idea, I'd never have gone to the war. He looked at her with a watery gaze, his eyes searching her face. He said, Pull your chair closer, young lady. My ears don't work so well as they once did. Her smile, like lightning in a cornfield, something about her made him think of his wife.
I was asking you, sir, if you were afraid. Your father was very ill.
William grunted. In Virginia, everyone was ill. The mosquitoes were feasting on all those poor New England boys. I dropped out of Notre Dame to go down there. That was in April of 1862, just in time for the March on Richmond. I don't know what my father thought of it. He knew McClellan from before the war, when the general was with the Illinois Central. They were close. He resigned when the general lost his command. William looked at the columnist and smiled. You know, Lincoln was the legal consultant for the railroad at the time. Small world. She raised her eyebrows, said nothing. I don't know what I was thinking, he went on. I stayed because I guess my father figured it was safer for me to serve under him, where he could keep an eye on me, rather than charging through the fields with the infantry. He was probably right. He never expected he'd get sick. He wasn't sick when I first got down there. William paused and blinked and stared at his hands. Do you really want to know all this? She smiled her dazzling smile.
My readers will be fascinated.
You said that already.
Mr. Pinkerton, she said,
and he could smell the perfume rising from her. Whatever else, he thought, Margaret never wore perfume like that.
She said, My readers are the proud mothers and sisters and wives of our boys in France. What they'll want to hear is the story of a patriot who served his country and returned home a hero.
He could feel the thrum of the big engines kicking down as the vessel began to shift its course, and he remembered the weird dappled light in the wet trees outside Gaines's mill all those years ago. The beauty of the blue fields at dusk, the eerie, crawling figures of the dying in the dawn mists after battle, the spray of men ripped to pieces, and the sounds of horses screaming, the clatter and boom of the artillery.
What they'll want to hear, he said, is the story of a boy who returned home. That's all.
She leaned forward and set a cool hand on his wrist. He dabbed at his mouth with a handkerchief. Her hair was cut in a bob and black, and her skin very pale, her lips very red. In an earlier decade he might have found her a wonder. Now, seeing her, he felt only tired and alone, and he was not surprised by the lack of fire in him, and this lack of surprise is how he knew he was old.
She said, Is it true, Mr. Pinkerton, that you went down to see your father because he had stopped writing letters to your mother?
Where did you hear that?
Oh, we journalists have our ways.
She winked. Your mother was worried because she could not reach him, and sent you down to make sure he was okay. You found him already weak. William was quiet.
And you stayed with him in the battlefields, despite the danger. You carried him on your back during the retreat. It is a beautiful story, Mr. Pinkerton, especially during wartime. So many of my readers have husbands and fathers serving in France. It will be such a comfort to them to be reminded that love can be stronger than war.
It isn't.
Her smile faltered.
It isn't stronger, and I didn't carry him on my back. I've heard that story. It isn't true. It didn't happen like that.
How did it happen?
The only thing my father ever let carry him was a sorrel that he loved more than his own two boys, and when that was short out from under him, he got up and walked home from the war, and he never looked back at it.
I know this is a difficult topic.
It's not difficult. Ask me something else.
She cleared her throat.
Ask me something else.
You left your fiancé in Boston to go to your father.
Margaret. Yes.
But she waited for you.
He shook his head. She was one of the Aisling daughters. He said, there were three of them. Famous beauties. I knew I was going to marry her from the moment I saw her, at the winter dance in Boston. She was with me in the field hospital at Antietam after I was injured. I woke up and she was there. My father was already back in Chicago by then.
It's such a beautiful story, Mr. Pinkerton.
It felt odd, speaking about this to a stranger after so many years. He still kept his wife's framed photograph on his bedside table each night. Still spoke to her under his breath in the mornings. He frowned suddenly. You wanted to ask me about the war, he said.
That's what I'm doing, sir.
No, it isn't. She gave him a long appraising look and then closed her little notebook and curled her fingers over the top of it and smiled gently.
Can I get you something to drink, Mr. Pinkerton?
No.
Soda water? Some tea?
Ask me something else, he said. When his father collapsed in the storehouse headquarters at Gaines's Mill, it was 2 days before the Confederate offensive at Malvern Hill, and already dusk and the slaughter had slowed to a groan. The door to the storehouse had been torn off and taken someplace away, and the flies were thick in the doorway. Though the great batteries had fallen silent in the trees, the hollering of boys clutching rifles and of men screaming in fear was still clattering and echoing in the fields. There was a gutter of the lantern, and William had looked up to see his father step back from the map and stand very still, and then all at once he fell. William lunged forward, caught him under the arms and staggered under the man's bulk, and then fell with him, ungainly and awkward as a calf. His father had been in a fever for days and not sleeping, skin blistering with sweat, shirt sleeves drenched in the heat, a greyness in his face. He had conceded nothing to it. A runner was sent. The litter bearers took their time, but came at last and rolled him, moaning, into the sling, and William walked alongside them in the mud off the boardwalks, with a hand slick on his father's boiling skin. Loaded wagons were being dragged across the camp, and there were men with their haversacks rolled, standing in groups near the southerly road. Someone was shouting. Someone was always shouting. In the hospital tent they set his father, shuddering, down among the rows of the dying, and his eyes rolled whitely back in his skull. William had never seen his father sick, and the sight of it made him afraid. That tent was a large tent. Along the walls hung lanterns creaking on their iron rings. The sick and the mutilated were dumped on rough beds of piled corn shucks. The smell was staggering. He saw boys with their bowels shot out, doubled over and seething with the pain, and they made no sound. Others blinded with stained bandages wrapped over their faces, others with arms in slings, with wrists dangling wrong. He saw orderlies digging with calipers for bullets or grape shot in the legs of half-naked men, their colleagues holding them down as they writhed. The ground was wet with muck, and William's boots slucked quietly where he stood, and he realized in disgust that it was blood that had soaked the earth, and when he looked behind him, he saw a slow foaming gutter of blood running through the mouth of the tent. He was all of 16 years old.
Pa, he said, I'll go fetch a doctor. You just stay here.
A hot, thorny hand grabbing at his wrist.
Willie! I'm here, Pa. It's me.
Willie. What is it, Willie? What?
But then his father closed his eyes and began to shake violently, and his teeth were clenched. He went out. There were wounded in the aisles trying to walk through their pain, and William pressed gingerly past them and lifted the flap of the tent. There was an ancient sentry posted at the door in the twilight. He held out a grimy hand. In his eyes, something unhinged and terrible.
I'm looking for a doctor, sir, William said. There's a man needs quinine in there.
Don't everyone.
The sentry's weathered face stared him down, as if gauging the boy's age in a baffled stupor. A jerk of his bearded jaw.
Go on through there, son.
The slick mud of the boardwalk. A small tent standing open just beyond. It was the field surgery. When William stepped in through the open flap, he was struck at once by the stink. The ripe, wet smell of shit and burned flesh. No one took any notice of him. A trestle table had been rigged up, using an old door and two sawhorses, and there was a man writhing upon it. His wrists were gripped hard. His head was held in place. There was an orderly with his bare arms wrapped around the man's leg at the knee, as if he were a colt to be branded. A doctor in his shirt sleeves was bent over the wounded with his back to William, and his arms were working furiously. Blood pouring down the table into the mud. A steady, wet rasping. The muffled groans of the sufferer. When the doctor turned his face, William saw he had his teeth clenched down around a lit cigar, and sweat dripping from his nose, and all at once William understood he was sawing off the man's leg. He did not speak, left the tent in a daze, his hands clutching at his thighs, doubled up and retching. The air was hot, the flies thick. He staggered through them. He could hear horses nearby, the creak of wagons loading. He stared out at the fires in the field beyond. There was a small pile of grey firewood in the long grass behind the tent, and as he turned to go, he caught the glint of eyes staring back at him. A dog, standing very quiet, very still. Then an orderly came out of the darkness with something in his arms, and he dumped it onto the pile, and gave William a strange look as he went back inside, and William saw it was a man's leg, and that the sticks were not sticks, but feet and arms and hands. When he got back, his father had twisted on to one side, and his legs were hot to the touch, and spraddled the bedding like a bad saddle, and William did not know what to do but wrestle him back into place. He felt sick and frightened and young. There was a man wearing a stained apron over a vest and shirt sleeves, walking down the far aisle with two orderlies at his side, and William waved to him in a panic, and he came angrily over. Thick-necked, thick-wristed, like a pugilist at a country fair. Sleeves tied off into knots, and blood in his knuckles. He was a doctor. "He's sick, sir," said William. Despite his youth, he was tall, and the doctor had to raise his eyes to meet his own. "It's the fever, sir. The malaria." "What's a goddamn civilian doing in my tent?" the doctor said.
"He's sick with the fever, sir," said an orderly. "He's not a civilian. This is Major Allen."
"I'm not talking about the patient."
William flushed. The second orderly had already turned away, and William saw this with a rising sense of terror. The doctor was wiping his hands up and down his apron, back to front, like a butcher, his pale whiskers bristling, bruises under his eyes.
"Please, sir. He's on General McClellan's staff, sir. He's head of the Secret Service."
"He's a spy."
William felt the heat rise to his cheeks.
"He's the spy, sir," he said angrily, "if you want to call it that. Don't let him die, sir. Please."
The doctor turned his face aside and spat into the mud and wiped his mouth with an open hand and stared hard at William. He said nothing. Then he reached for his notepad and scrawled out a ticket for quinine and stuffed it with distaste into William's hand as if it were a soiled handkerchief, and turned and, without so much as a glance at William's father, walked away. It had been that way for weeks. After a month of hot rain and foul vapors, the mosquitoes had bred in the millions. Malaria had boiled up out of the swamps and into the bloodstreams of the Federal Army, and for weeks already, men had been shivering in the ranks, collapsing in the pickets. Some too weak to sight their rifles, some too weak to lift a hand. Even when the Confederates rushed in waves of gray from the tree line, screaming. Even when the bayonet slid between their ribcages. There were men in the field tents who had been carved to pieces by enemy fire, and men who had been gutted by disease, and the wounded would die bravely, the sick would suffer in cowardice. That was how it was. Ask any surgeon. No soldier worth his brass fell out for shitting his pants. The quartermasters ran out of quinine by the third week of June, and after that, the doctors left the shivering masses to their fevers. William ransacked his father's pockets and turned out a riveted leather billfold, and this he tucked down the front of his tunic. He took his father's Colt and checked its chamber, then slipped it into the pocket of his coat, and he squeezed his father's shoulder. In the lantern light, his father's chin was a crescent of darkness. His flushed throat, trembling, as if palsied. A boy across the tent started to scream. He went out. The Confederates had not overrun them, but William could see the chaos of the camp and the exhaustion of the men as they kicked down their tents, slung up their packs in the firelight. There were soldiers standing in the days around small fires, and the air was already cooling, though the ground felt hot still, and the heat poured up off it like something pestilential and evil. William went quickly, standing aside in the mud when tired men crowded past on the boardwalks, and at last he shrugged up his shoulders and just waded through the muck. There were others hurrying through it also. He could not see what it was he sloshed through, though he had some idea, having watched the soldiers void themselves in it, and the cooks dump their scraps, and the sutlers kick aside their opened cans, like razored shells, into the stew of it. The quartermasters had already started to crate up their stores, and they took what they could, but the packing seemed crazed and fearful and made no sense. There were shelves of tinned beans and boxes of cigars left unsealed, but a crate of soap had been nailed and cross-nailed shut. Some stared at William, and some shook their heads, and some did not bother to reply. The sutlers were rougher, laughing and pushing each other drunkenly aside. One lashed out with a boot, but lost his footing as he did so, and William turned away. As he was leaving, a boy his own age took him by the sleeve and drew him aside out of the light and said, "I know where you can get quinine." William looked at him. There was a hunger to the boy, a viciousness that made him uneasy. He wore a filthy Union infantry shirt. "Going to cost you, though." "How much?" A pale tip of a tongue, crooked brown teeth. He cocked his head and said, $5. The boy's small eyes were wet in the darkness. "Show me," William said. The boy set off through the grass behind the tents, and he did not look back to see that William followed. There were fires in the night, wearied soldiers sitting around them. As they walked, William slid his fingers down his shirt and took out 5 bills from his father's wallet and slipped them into his trouser pocket. The boy led him to a small fire where a man sat turning strips of bacon over in a pan with a knife, and he raised his eyes and watched them approach, but he did not stop at his labors.
"Orville," the boy said, "this here's looking for the quinine."
The man frowned, a long line of stubble along his jaw, thick black mustaches and heavy eyebrows and greasy gray hair clotted down his back. He punched out his cap and set it on his head and grunted.
"He don't look sick."
"It's not for me," William said foolishly.
"It's $6,
the man said.
"He said 5.
7.
William looked at the boy, and the boy spat and shrugged, and no one said anything. All at once the man smiled.
All right, he said. "Let's just take it easy now. You hungry?"
He held out a leaf of rasher on his knife, but William did not move to take it, and instead put his hand in his pocket.
"Says he's got money, Orville,"
the boy said. He sidled over and sat on a log near the fire, and reached into a satchel and withdrew a tall green bottle. It was whiskey.
"I said quinine,"
William said.
"There's quinine in it,"
the boy said.
"You put that away," the man said. "And you seat yourself down."
He bit the bacon from the blade and chewed it slowly. The boy was dragging a stick through the dirt with the bottle clamped between his knees, and William frowned and turned his face into the darkness. He could hear enlisted men stamping through the muck, muttering. The man grunted.
"Interesting uniform you got on there."
William glanced uneasily around.
"Where you say you were fighting today?"
the man said. William blinked. He took his hand from his pocket, and in it was his father's Colt, and his hand was very steady.
"I'll take the bottle," he said. $5, if it's really quinine."
The man rested the blade of his knife on his thigh, and he stared up at the Colt. He smiled a disappointed smile.
"It's quinine,"
he said. The boy did not smile, his two hands still clutching the bottle by the neck. William held out the $5 to the boy, and the man nodded, and the boy took it. And William took the bottle. It was not heavy. He took 2 deliberate steps backward away from the fire without turning around, and the boy watched with glittering eyes. Then he turned and went. At the hospital, they had taken his father from the tent and dumped him outside in the cold among those suffering dysentery and other hopeless cases, and it took William several minutes to find him. He was on the far side of those dying boys, and he kneeled beside him and put a hand on his wrist, and his father opened his burning eyes.
"Willie," he whispered, "your mother was here."
He did not know if there was quinine in that whiskey, but he uncorked the bottle and cradled his father's skull in his hand and drew the bottle to his lips. A flare of light from a passing torch burned through the buckled green glass, passed and was gone.
"Go on, drink," he whispered. "Good, like that."
His father drank off a third of the whiskey, then started to cough, and twisted onto his side and coughed and coughed. William tucked the bottle in his shirt, the glass cool against his skin. Then his father lay back on the rugged husks, and William watched him, and after a while he lay down next to him, feeling the heat pour from his father's flesh, and he pulled the coat up over them and closed his eyes, and together they slept. The next morning dawned muggy and hot. There was mist in the long yellow grass. Bodies lay around them tangled on the corn husks, and all looked grey and still, and he could see in the nearest the white staring eyes of the dead. He lifted his face and looked at his father, and then tucked his coat more tightly against his father's sleeping form, and rubbed at his neck, and he rose. The sentries were gone. The low mist crept over the ground, and there were no fires burning in the camp. The mud underfoot had thickened. Tangles of rope, broken crates, clothing and dry goods strewn over the field. During the night, most of the tents had been struck. Porter's 5th Corps had moved out with the wagons. There were only the dying and the stragglers left. He reached for the whiskey in his shirt, but it was gone. He did not know what to do. He went out in search of something to eat, but could find only a box of salt crackers, and these he tore into with his teeth bared and the crumbs exploding. A weak sunlight was coming in through the grey trees. On a low rise he found the sutlers' tents slumped and pulled off their stakes, and their goods turned out in the mud. On his way back, he lifted the flap of the hospital tent and saw the beds evacuated. He did not go into the surgery. There was a man standing over his father when he returned, and he felt something cold go through him. The man's back was to him, and he was rubbing one hand slowly on his pant leg, and the sound of it seemed all at once eerie and awful and menacing. William came up on the other side of his sleeping father, the Colt still in his pocket.
"What do you want?" he said.
The man was wearing a forage cap with a small brass balloon insignia on it. He lifted his face. He had no eyebrows, no eyelashes. His eyes were very blue. He had been burned once, and the skin had scarred over, and the man's cheeks and mouth and nose looked soft and pitted and shiny like poured wax. William took the Colt from his pocket.
"What happened to you?"
The man grunted.
"Slept through the muster," he said. "Look at these poor bastards."
William watched him. The man looked up and saw the Colt.
"Jesus, lad, I got left behind. It happens."
William said nothing.
"I ain't a deserter."
"I meant what happened to your face."
The man's eyes fixed on William, and then his mouth twisted into a smile.
"A hydrogen balloon ignited it," he said. "I was an aeronaut before all this. A balloonist."
The man gestured at William's father with a gnarled hand.
"I reckon you're going to want some help with him. What is it? Malaria?"
"I think so."
The burned man nodded.
"I'd say so.
If I can just get him to headquarters."
The burned man stepped closer in the warming mud, and leaned over his father, and stared at his face, and after a moment said softly,
"I'll be damned."
When he looked up, the expression in his eyes had darkened.
"You know who this is?"
"Major Allen, of McClellan's staff."
William lowered the Colt.
"You know him?"
"I'm an aeronaut, kid. We're in intelligence ourselves."
William took a step forward.
"Will you help me with him?"
he said in a low, urgent voice. The man peered around as if thinking better of it. At last he nodded.
"I guess we're going the same way," he said.
They took little. Someone had been through William's things in the night, but he still had his bedroll and a pair of dry socks, and a water skin, and he took these along with whatever food he could scrounge up. All this he slung over one shoulder, and with his father slumping wearily between them, the three began the slow walk southward to the James River. The road was rutted and the mud 2 feet deep in places, and everywhere they saw evidence of the Union Army's retreat. Rifles discarded in the mud, sacks of food, thick officers' coats with fur collars, and the arms stitched in relief. They touched none of it. There was no sign of Confederate scouts, though they knew the rebels would be coming. They talked little. William's father drifted and muttered and shook his head and coughed. His skin was hot and bloodless. By mid-morning, they had come upon the army's rear guard and began to pass the soldiers on the side of the road. Some turned out with boots pulled off and rubbing at their feet, others sitting with their rifles between their knees and faces bent earthward. All were weighed down with ransacked stores from the fleeing sutlers, cigars stuffed in their mouths, pockets packed down with bars of soap, crates of cigars on their shoulders. Some crazed few were rolling enormous slow barrels of whiskey over the ruts in the road. There was a terrible carnival aspect to it all. One soldier lay spread-eagled in the road, drunk. Another shifted boxes of foot powder from a broken tin trunk into a wheelbarrow. They walked shuffling past. A burned man, a sick man, a boy. No one challenged them. They slept in a clearing with their backs to the trees, listening for the sound of an army on the road, the cold grass sticking to their legs. That night, the temperature dropped, and they folded hands into their armpits for warmth. They did not risk a fire, and in the morning when they rose, William's father was worse.
"He's going to die,"
the burned man said.
"No, he won't."
"You've got to get him to a doctor. He won't make it out of here."
"He's my father."
The burned man squinted up at the gray sky.
"I know it,"
he said. The day grew hot again. There were wagons on the road when they set out, and the drivers told them to head for Savage's Station. All were heavily laden. None could spare a space for William's father. William cursed them and they kicked out their boots, but it was half-hearted and pointless, and no one drew a gun. The great wheels banging and creaking over the ruts, the starved horses with their drooping heads, their breath pluming out before them. It started to rain a warm, mist-like rain, and William wiped his hair back from his face and they went on. They reached Savage's Station along the railroad by noon. Rows of high, grey tents in the rain. A confusion of men. A fenced perimeter stood in place around the hospital, and they passed pockets of infantry, huddled in the trees, and then they were in the chaos of the evacuating camp. The hospital was a clabbered shack, with wounded figures huddled outside it, and there was a big tent with the flaps tied back, and a dark smell in the beyond. A big wagon train stood sealed and under guard, without the horses to haul it away. They pushed through the crowds, and at the entrance to the hospital, William set his father down on a broken ladder that served as a bench, and the burned man stared fiercely out at the figures in the rain.
"You'll have to manage him now," he said. "I need to find Colonel Lowe. Runs the balloon corps. I need to report in."
William looked at him, and he shrugged.
"What?"
the burned man said.
"You thought I was army? Aviators are civilians, kid. The uniform doesn't mean anything."
He twisted his ravaged face, nodded at William's father.
"Get him to the infirmary,"
he said, and turned to go. William looked around at the whirl of men and the grey, blanketed wounded in the muck, and something in it all made him uneasy.
"Wait,"
he called. The burned man turned.
"I don't think we should stop. He needs medical attention, kid."
"Not here."
"He needs quinine, look at him."
William got to his feet. The burned man had taken 2 steps out of the yard, and paused, and now he came back.
"I know who your father is,"
he said quietly.
"I mean before the war. I know what he used to do. I know about the agency."
William had been assured only 2 men in the ranks knew his father's real identity, Benjamin Porter and General McClellan himself.
"If you know who he is," he said cautiously, "then help me get him out of here. The Confederates are coming. This place will be overrun."
"It won't be."
"Please.
I'm not getting myself killed over this, kid."
"So come with us."
The burned man took off his cap and raised his face and closed his eyes, and the rain was coming down over him and into his open mouth.
"Your father," he said, "was investigating graft in Philadelphia when my brother was working for the post office. Started working in the office with him. Got friendly. turned on him. My brother got 7 years. William stood quiet in the rain.
He's still in jail.
He was guilty?
Maybe.
William met the burned man's gaze.
He was guilty and got put away, he said coldly. I wish I could say I was sorry for him. Maybe he's lucky. If he's in jail, then he's not down here.
The burned man scowled, nodded.
Well, he was a bastard.
William looked at his father.
Not him. My brother. You really are his kid. Pinkertons.
He nodded.
William.
The burned man studied him.
Ignatius Spar,
he said.
I can't carry him myself, Mr. Spar.
Spar scowled at the federal soldiers leaving through the gates with their packs clanking and rifles slung.
My brother always was a bastard, he muttered. He always was that.
Against his better instincts, he waited, but he did not approach Sumner's staff, and the hour came and went while Spar hunted for some word of his fellow aeronauts. William sat with his father. He stood with his father. He dragged his father through the mud to the southerly road. Then out of the shifting crowd, a figure stepped forward and set a hand on William's arm, and when he turned, he found himself staring into the wide, powerful face of a black man, the rain running from his chin. He reached up and wiped a hat, shapeless as a feed bag, from his head, and his nostrils flared.
Look like you ready to drop,
the man said in a soft, rich voice, a flash of gold teeth.
Mr. Porter?
William said, confused.
Ah, now, take it easy.
He reached down and hefted William's father with one massive arm, and crossed to a narrow shelter beside the fence, and propped the feverish man against a barrel and murmured,
Now what you so poorly with, Major?
And lifted his face and felt for his heartbeat.
It's the fever,
William said. We're trying to get him somewhere safe.
Shoot, that ain't here.
I know it.
Sally's back at Harrison's Landing. She going to know what to do.
Benjamin Porter and his wife had been working with William's father in service to the Union since the outbreak of the war, running spies across the lines, under the guise of slaves. They had been friends of the Pinkertons since fleeing the South 3 years before, when they had hidden under the floorboards of the Pinkerton kitchen. William trusted the man the way he trusted his own brother. He could not stop himself now from reaching up and holding the man's arm, and he felt a sudden upwelling of relief. But then they heard the sound of firing from behind them, and men were running. Spar materialized out of the chaos, and looked at Ben with a curious expression. A grizzled old sergeant was with him.
Mr. Spar, Ben said, you a long way from the balloonists.
Spar tilted his cap back from his eyes, the rain swishing from the leather brim.
I'm looking for them now, he said. Are they all up at Harrison's Landing already?
The sergeant, who had returned with him, ran a hand over his face to wipe away the rain.
You all should get out now if you're going, he said. Magruder's units are coming out of the west. Jackson's in the north. It'll get hot here.
Get out to where?
William asked.
Malvern Hill. The companies are regrouping. They'll make a stand there.
Ben shifted William's father on his shoulder.
This here is Major Allen, of McClellan's staff. Ain't there some wagon he can ride out on?
The sergeant squinted.
If there were a wagon, I'd be on it myself, boy. You get him over to headquarters at Malvern House.
Malvern House?
Yes.
Spar grimaced.
How do we get there?
A Spencer repeater started shooting from the lines, its quick, sharp crack, and then several others started up, and the sergeant was already turning away.
Follow the goddamn army, he called. You'll know it's ours by the backs of their damned trousers.
And trudged through the thick mud with his shoulders hunched, and his long hair matted down his back, and his colt slapping at his leg. It was late afternoon when they set out, and still raining in a long, slow, languid rain, and the water was warm on their necks, and soon they were soaked through. Discarded packs and greatcoats and rifles littered the ditches, but they did not stop to pick through them. The soldiers escorting them had been drinking and would stumble to their knees and shoot at every shadow in the fog. No one helped them carry his father, and the mud on the road was deep, the going slow. Behind them the big guns started to sound, but they walked on without a word, and by dusk the guns had fallen silent and they understood Savage's station had been overrun.
A lifetime later, William would watch the columnist slide one long thigh up over the other, adjust the hem of her dress in the quiet of that cabin. The ocean light fading, the brass portholes burning bright and cold high up in the walls. He reached for the pitcher of water, an orchid of light.
"Mr. Pinkerton."
She tapped her pencil against her lips, flipped back through her notebooks. "Tell me about the balloon battle," she said. "Tell me about Malvern Hill."
"Malvern Hill."
She gave him a soft, sympathetic look.
"If you can, Mr. Pinkerton.
I know it was a long time ago."
50 years.
"Yes."
A steward in his pressed whites came to the door, glanced in, went on his way. William studied the columnist there in the silvering light, deciding something. Margaret's ghostly double. A faint scent of salt air and whitewash reached him, the tang of oil rubbed into the millwork. What did he remember? 50 years ago, someone, somewhere, had been singing a low hymn. There had been crying in the twilight. Hogs feeding on the dead all night as the wounded wept and called for water. Then the skies opening in the early dawn. The rain coming down. Him wading hip-deep through the grass and his trousers cold and soaking. There had been boys, huddled at the mouths of tents. Terrible eyes. He told her, "It wouldn't stop raining. Wheat was in the shock. Oats ready for harvest. Corn waist high. We'd been retreating back up the peninsula all week. They call it the 7 days battles now, but that isn't accurate. At the time, it just felt like we were running. We called it the infernal week. We didn't know where anyone was. It seemed half the time we were just afraid of falling behind the Confederate lines. We kept hearing they were coming up and coming up, but we didn't see much of them. But we'd pass wounded on the side of the road, boys with their feet shot off, men with their arms in slings. So we knew someone somewhere was fighting. Malvern Hill was the last of it. After that, the Confederates fell back."
"You were assigned to the Balloon Corps?"
William frowned. "No. Well, during the battle, yes. I'd been a dispatch rider all week, but because of my light weight, I ended up in the balloon. We went up to try to get a sense of what was going on. We had a direct line by telegraph with the general's headquarters, and we sent them our observations, but they didn't help much. I think we helped the howitzers locate their targets some. The heavy Parrott guns looked all wrong to us, but our batteries had the high ground, wide sweeping fields of fire. It was nearly a perfect day of killing." He went quiet for a moment, then said, "The hill was bisected by a long Quaker road. There were two streams down below where the forest broke, and these funneled the Confederate forces into a narrow assault. It was only just a mile wide or so. It made for a slaughter." She shivered.
"I think I'd be terrified to go up in a balloon."
"Scared the tar out of me, too."
"What happened to your balloon when it broke loose?"
"When it, what?"
"Broke loose.
Didn't your balloon break loose? Wasn't there a free flight over the Confederate positions during the battle?"
"No."
"There wasn't a free flight?"
"No."
She studied him, but did not say anything for a moment. Glanced at her notebook, pale brow furrowing.
"It must have been a very confusing time," she said.
"Not that confusing. I hope the war in France isn't as terrible. For our boys over there, I mean." William smoothed the blanket on his knee, his big hands gnarled but still strong. He said, "The war for the Union cast a long shadow. I guess maybe every war does. But used to be you'd meet a man who'd fought in it, and there was an understanding between you."
"Hmm.
I don't know. I think when a man comes back from a war, the rest of his life is already written. Whatever happens, it's all a long descent from that place. Most of us are glad to be leaving it. Some of us don't ever really get to. It doesn't much matter. You live with it."